You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. And now, here's Rod Adams and the Atomic Show. It's atomic, yeah. It's atomic.
This is the Atomic Show, show number 38, I believe. And tonight I'm going to be talking with George Stanford, who is a physicist retired from the Argonne National Laboratory. And George, during his career, spent a lot of time involved in doing reactor safety evaluations. And I would guess, based on the laboratory that you worked at, and some of the projects that were going on at the time, that you were probably involved with liquid metal reactors. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, one of the projects that the Argonne National Laboratory has worked on for a number of years is the use of liquid metal sodium, and I think you all have worked on other kinds of liquid metal reactors. Is that true?
Yes, especially more recently.
What other kinds of coolants have been evaluated by argon for use in reactors?
Well, argon concentrated on sodium, and until the project was shut down, the IFR project, and was shut down in 1995, sodium was the main one that argon was working on. But since then, there have been proposals to go to lead or lead bismuth, and that can has the potential for going to a higher temperature. So that's why there's an interest in that.
Okay, now the IFR was the integral fast reactor, and that was, about a 60-megawatt thermal reactor, something like that?
The power, of course, depended would depend on the application. There was never a prototype built. Well, there was never a demonstration model on commercial scale, but there was a prototype working in Idaho, which, of course, was a very low power. But I think they anticipated around 300 megawatts electric.
Okay.
And down from there.
Right. But you did have a actual reactor working out in Idaho that I believe was...
Yes, the EBR-2, Experimental Breeder Reactor 2, it was a research reactor, but it did not, it was not a power production reactor.
Okay. And the reason I invited George onto the show was a couple of shows ago, I talked to Dr. Rodney Ewing from University of Michigan, and George had some very perceptive comments to make about that show, sent them to me via email, and talked about some of the things that perhaps Dr. Ewing and I didn't get around to talking about when we discussed some of the potential increased usability of nuclear fuels. As you all have heard me talk about before, one of the things that bothers me at times is when people talk about the material that comes out of current generation reactors as being waste, when in fact it's still got a large amount of potential energy left in it. And George had a few comments on some of the ways in which we could get more energy out of uranium before deciding it was time to put it away for good. So, George, can you tell me a little bit about why the fast reactors, those reactors that use higher energy neutrons, have been so interesting to argon and argon researchers over the years?
Yes, the reason for the interest in fast reactors is that when the neutrons are not slowed down as they are in almost all of the power reactors operating today, but if they remain fast, then you get more neutrons released for every atom that gets split, for every fission event. And therefore, that gives the potential for a more complete burn-up of the of the fuel. It gives you extra neutrons to use for breeding, if you want to go that route. But also, it permits the higher actinides to be used as fuel much more efficiently than can be done in a thermal reactor.
Okay. One of the things that I've always, you know, I'm not a physicist myself, but I know a little bit about how the reactors operate, and it's always seemed to me that even with thermal reactors, the higher actinides would eventually break apart, because they won't just keep absorbing more and more neutrons. But maybe I'm a little bit simplistic in my understanding of how that works.
Yeah, it doesn't somehow work out that way, because the higher actinides get harder and harder to work with in a thermal reactor. And you get not only plutonium-239, which of course is a very nicely fissile element or isotope, but you also get the plutonium-240 and 242, which are not fissile and which end up as sort of poisons. And they do not get efficiently consumed in thermal reactors.
Right. Now, as I understand it, pretty much in the actinide world, everything that's got an odd weight is somewhat fissile, and everything with an even weight prefers to absorb a neutron rather than break apart.
Yes, that's right. They call them fissile and fertile. The even numbered isotopes are called fertile because they, when they absorb a neutron, they do become fissile and then can be used as fuel.
Okay. Now, in a fast reactor, though, the neutrons have enough energy to actually cause the even numbered isotopes to break apart. Is that correct?
Yes, to some extent. Not as readily as the fissile atoms, but they do. They do undergo fission to some extent, but also, as I say, there's extra neutrons for converting those fertile atoms into fissile ones, and that is the main advantage of the fast spectrum.
Okay. Now, some isotopes themselves release more neutrons per fission than, say, uranium-235 does. I think that, like, uranium-232 is one of those that, even in a thermal reactor, releases more neutrons on average. Not very many more, but enough more to make a difference.
Okay, I'll take your word for that.
Well, the reason I say that is because I know that there was a program, the last reactor of the shipping port reactor was loaded with a special core that included uranium-233 as a seed, and thorium-232 as a blanket, and actually demonstrated breeding in a thermal reactor.
Yes, a slight breeding. It was not, you couldn't get the breeding ratio that you can with a fast reactor. But it is true that U-233 is a very fissile, it's a very good bomb material, as a matter of fact.
Sure, it's a good bomb material. For those of people who decide they want to use it for a bomb, they have trouble finding it, though, since it doesn't
yes.
occur anywhere.
It can be produced, of course, in a thorium-fueled reactor, but nobody, to my knowledge, has made a U-233 bomb.
Right. Of course, there's some folks out there these days who are talking about thorium as a reactor fuel, and one of the things that they attempt to say is that uranium-233 is not a very good bomb material, but
that's not correct. What they mean when they say that is that it tends to be contaminated with uranium-232, which is very well. It's sort of a poison and is very radioactive. And so what you want to do, if you were going to use it to make a bomb with 233, what you would want to do is separate the protactinium 233, which I said uranium 232. I'm sorry, I'm confused a little. Yeah, that's correct. Anyway, when the thorium 232 absorbs a neutron, it becomes U-233, but it first goes through protactinium 233, which can be chemically separated so that you get pure U-233. And that is an excellent bomb material.
Okay, and I understand that. And the good thing about talking and maybe not having complete memories of things is that it's hard for anybody to take our words and turn them into, you know, actual technology. So that, you know, we're talking in general terms. So when you were working on the fast reactors, what kind of efficiency or consumption or maybe burn up, I guess is the right term, of the nuclear fuels do you think you were able to reach in those designs?
I think, well, for a single cycle, I think it was around 15% to 20%, as I recall. But of course, the main thing is that if you keep recycling the unfissioned material back into the reactor, so that you get essentially over 99% of the energy out of the uranium and the elements that are produced in the course of the transuranic elements can all be consumed. So if by burn up you mean efficiency of utilizing the resource, it's close to 100%. Whereas in thermal reactors, it's less than 1%. So you've got a factor of 100 there in resource utilization.
That's pretty impressive improvement. That's as a person who studies the normal change of course in technology, they talk about an S-curve where you start, you know, down low and you only do a little bit, and then eventually you start learning more and more about the activity, and you have a really quick rate of increase, and eventually you get towards the top asymptote where you really can't do much more improvement. So it's always been my contention that the light water reactors of today are pretty close to the bottom of that S-curve, and there's an awful long way to go before we approach, you know, full utilization or full efficiency for the system.
Yeah, well, you can't do it. It's impossible to do it with thermal reactors.
Yep. Of course, there are people that say that there's, you know, enough uranium around to continue using it in the way that we're using it for quite some time.
That's true. And that's true, but there are consequences. For one thing, of course, plutonium is building up by the ton every year around the world. Secondly, the amount of waste is becoming unmanageable. And so those are two reasons for wanting two reasons that I advocate going to fast reactors, because they will handle they'll essentially solve the waste problem instead of having to wait for 10,000 years for something to decay. The isolation for about 300 years is sufficient to get it down to way below background and below any concern.
Yeah, and actually I've got a couple of readers and listeners who have been making some fairly detailed comments on my blog and on the podcast with regard to the fact that they don't like to think of any of the products of fission as waste materials, because they're very excited about some of the isotopes that are created when you break uranium apart, and some of the potential uses for some of those isotopes.
Yes, whether you could, I don't think we could use them all, but certainly there are medical uses and other uses.
Yeah, I'm sure that there are some that can't be used, but in general, the isotopes that are created are rare materials with unique physical properties, and you know, if somebody has a creative use for them, they might have some potential value. I used to like to think about using the strontium 90, for example, as a heat source for.
Yeah, when I say use them all, I meant to use them in the quantity that they would be generated. But fine, if people find use for them, that's great.
Yeah, because the whole idea of just, you know, calling that stuff waste is a little bit...
Yes, that's a mistake.
Yeah. I mean, even some of the materials that are really not the fission products or even the transuranics, you know, we spend a lot of money trying to isolate zirconium, for example, and turning it into the tubes to contain the fission products. And it seems to me that we ought to be able to recover some of that metal too, if we were doing this in a you know, long term fashion. Now the fast reactors, they don't use the same kinds of fuel shapes, so do they?
Same kind of what?
Of fuel composition. I guess in light water reactors you have uranium dioxide pellets inside of a tube of zirconium. How do you do it with the fast reactors?
Well, fast reactors can be made with oxide fuel, but you can, for one thing, you can't get the breeding ratio with oxide fuel that you can with metal fuel. And so the fuel that, for instance, Argonne Laboratory was working with was metallic fuel, which has a number of advantages.
Well, what are some of the advantages? That's an open-ended question.
Beg your pardon? The advantages?
Yes, that answer begs the question. What are some of the advantages of the metallic fuel?
Well, one advantage of metal fuel is that it's a good heat conductor, and so in the operating reactor, you don't have the amount of heat built up in the center of the fuel pins that you do in an oxide reactor, which means that if the reactor is shut down for, say, lack of coolant or something, you don't have as much of a heat to dissipate as you do in a thermal reactor. So that's somewhat of a safety advantage.
Now,
another advantage with the metal fuel is that you can get a much higher breeding ratio with metal than you can with oxide.
Okay. Now, with regard to the safety aspects, I recall that the EBR-2 did an experiment. It happens that it was done about April of 1986, where there was some actual testing done of the passive safety features of that plant.
Yes.
Do you remember?
Yeah, they put it through two different scenarios. One where I forget the details, but I think one where all the power to the plant was shut off and the operators didn't do anything, and the other was when I think they stopped all the coolant or something and the operators didn't do anything. In other words, they more or less did the sort of accident that happened at Three Mile Island and the one at Chernobyl, and in both cases the reactor shut itself down without any damage.
I find it interesting, as I went back and looked at that this afternoon and realized exactly what month those tests were conducted, because it seems like at the end of that month is when Chernobyl occurred.
It was around that time, yes.
Yeah, I believe that that's one of the reasons why the results of those tests were essentially lost for history. I mean, they were reported, obviously, but by that time people weren't paying much attention.
Yeah.
So timing wasn't all that good, I guess.
Right, yeah, that was too bad.
Now, the IFR experienced a rather abrupt shutdown of its planned experimentation.
Yes. It was in 1990, I said 95, maybe it was 94. It was shut down for what I think were mistaken reasons. It wasn't shut down for, the program was discontinued not for technical reasons, but because there was a fear that the reprocessing involved would contribute to the proliferation of nuclear weapons.
Now, if I remember correctly, that integral part of the integral fast reactor was that the pyroprocessing occurred without the material ever leaving the plant. Is that?
Yes. That's another advantage of the metal fuel, in that you can do the pyroprocessing, which never produces pure plutonium. And so once you ship fuel into the plant, then nothing comes out of it except nothing leaves the plant except the fission products. You never get any plutonium coming out except for trace amounts.
Yeah. Now the pyroprocessing essentially is a melting process, right? Where you simply can separate the heavy stuff from the light stuff.
Well, it uses a salt as a solvent. It's a chemical process, and it's a liquid. It done at a pretty high temperature, but it doesn't use water. It uses molten salt as the liquid solvent.
Okay. And with pyroprocessing, do you have as much of the chemical waste or chemical solvents to dispose of as you do with the, say, the Purex process or something like that?
Waste that you have to dispose of is, at least with the radioactive part, is due to the fission products. And, of course, the fission products do have to be disposed of. They can be solidified and vitrified and put in some safe place.
Okay. But the salt that's used as a solvent, does that keep getting reused and you just...
I think so, yes.
Okay. Yeah, that's...
I'm not a chemist, so I'm not too familiar with the chemical details, but the salt is reused.
Okay. Yeah, now the IFR was shut down back in 94, but the plant was put into a condition where there was people who were advocating a restart of the project all the way up, well... Maybe I'm getting confused. I always get confused between the EBR-2 and the fast flux test reactor, FF.
Oh, yes, the FFTF.
Yeah. So maybe the EBR-2 was shut down pretty quickly in the 90s under the watchful eye of Hazel O'Leary.
Of what?
Hazel O'Leary, I believe she
was.
Yes,
Hazel O'Leary, that's right.
Secretary of Energy.
Yes, of course, she did what the Congress told her to do. There was a vote in the U.S. Senate that terminated the program.
Yeah, I think that the administration recommended termination.
Oh, yes, that's right.
As far as I remember the process, in the budget submitted for 1993 or 94, they zeroed out the experimentation phase and reprogram that money for a cleanup or decommission shutdown phase.
Right.
And,
actually, it was not, of course, shut down for financial reasons, because it was only, as I recall, $300 to $400 million left to bring the demonstrations to a conclusion, and the Japanese were willing to pay a good part of that.
Yeah.
So it certainly wasn't for technical, neither for technical nor financial reasons.
No, at that time in the 90s, there was, not much optimism for nuclear energy. Of course, Hazel O'Leary, before she was the Secretary of Energy, if I remember correctly, was a lobbyist for the natural gas industry.
Uh-huh.
And,
I'd forgotten that.
Yeah, well, one of my theories, George, is that there's a lot of... little pointers that say that the fossil fuel industry was one of the reasons why the nuclear industry was so politically unpopular. I believe they spent a lot of money trying to make sure the competition didn't come too quickly. But anyway,
right? Actually, I don't think they need to worry. because we're going to be using oil, for instance, for a long time for transportation because there's no good substitute. And the coal is going to be burned for quite a while also because we just can't get nuclear power going rapidly enough to make any early dent in the usage of coal.
Well, yeah,
the Chinese, as I understand it, are bringing on a big coal plant every 5 days or something. Is it? Maybe you know better than I.
It's something close to that. I think that they are building something on the order of 150 a year or 100 a year. So that'd be about every 3 days. So.
Yeah, and that's those are not going to be clean plants either, as I understand it. So we're going to get lots of CO2 and sulfur dioxide and nitrogen and acid rain and so on from not only China but the other places as well. So it's not too soon to get going in a big way with nuclear power.
No, I agree. And but when I talk about the efforts of the fossil fuel industry, that there certainly is nobody who would say that nuclear power is going to push them out of the market anytime soon.
Right.
However, if you look at the profitability of the fossil fuel industry, you can recognize that it doesn't take a large swing in the amount of other alternative energies to have a big shift in the price of fossil fuel. And if one's selling fossil fuel, you would much rather sell it at $70 or $80 a barrel than you would at $30 or $40 a barrel.
Right.
one of
the uses for nuclear power is to access more oil, because the oil shale in the western U.S. and the oil sands in Canada, there's a lot of oil there, but it's hard to get at, and it takes energy. And as I understand it, it takes something like a third of the energy you get from the oil just to extract more. And if that heat can be supplied with nuclear power, then that gives that much more oil for the for useful things.
Oh, I fully agree with you, and most consumers would agree with you also. But I can tell you that suppliers of oil from Saudi Arabia are perhaps not so excited about the prospects of a large amount of oil coming out of Canada.
That's right, and but it will if the oil companies can be assured that the price isn't going to be driven down so far that it's no longer profitable to extract that oil. But if the price should appear to be stabilizing around where it is now, I believe that it would be quite profitable to get the oil out of the oil shale and the oil sands.
Yep, it is definitely profitable at current prices, but if you watch prices closely, you can see that even over the last, say, 10 months or so, the price of oil has dropped by about $15 a barrel. And for every dollar that the price of a barrel of oil drops, the income to Saudi Arabia changes by about $9 million a day. Right?
Yes.
I mean, if you're producing...
You have a balancing act to perform.
Right. You're producing 9 million barrels of oil a day. A change of the world price of $15 is a big deal to you.
Right.
And it's not just Saudi Arabia. I'm just using them as an example. That's some of the economics that many people, I don't know, sometimes don't pay as much attention to, but I've spent more time studying business than I have studying physics. So.
Roger's fading away a little bit.
Oh, am I? Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. Maybe I was getting a little bit far from my microphone. But, well, it sounds to me like the metal reactors were the specialty of argon. Did you have anything to do or have any knowledge of the Toshiba 4S design that?
I know about it. They're proposing to use it at. That they've offered to give the town of Galena, Alaska, one of them to supply their electricity. They're going to give it to them as a demonstration loss leader.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's an application before the NRC, if I'm not wrong, to for licensing for it. I don't think it's been acted on yet.
Yeah, it seems to me that when I looked at the design for the 4S, it looked very similar to a design that I had found discussed at Argonne National Laboratory, which was several, maybe a decade or so ago, and it was a little bit larger than the 4S design, but it sure looked like it had very similar features, like the...
Oh, yes, it certainly is. It's sodium-cooled and metal-fueled, I believe, and so it is quite similar. And the 4S, the one that they would give to Galena, is quite a small one. I forget, 10 or 15 megawatts or something, but they can be built, of course, up to 200 or 300.
Right. Now the... Go ahead.
An advantage of that is that it's they call it a nuclear battery, and because they can ship it in and let it run for about, I think they're predicting 30 years, and then the core is exhausted, and then they take it away again. And so the operators don't have to know any nuclear technology or anything, or they don't even have to be particularly skilled, because the thing pretty well controls itself and is passively safe and so on. So it's very good for giving to, or for instance, for renting to developing countries who need energy and don't need to have nuclear technology.
Right. Of course, it's one of those things where it's not just countries per se, but there's probably plenty of people who would like to have energy available to them, say if they're running a remote mine somewhere, and they don't necessarily want to have a large investment in nuclear operators. They just like to have somebody that can run a steam plant.
Oh, that's right. In fact, one of the companies that I think should be interested in that is the International Nickel Company in Canada, where they have great need for energy in
right.
their mines.
Yeah, particularly since nickel happens to be, for some reason, concentrated in areas where it's pretty darn cold most of the time.
Yeah, as I understand it, the nickel deposit in Canada is because of a giant meteorite that landed quite a while ago.
Okay. Yeah, I know that there's a fair amount of nickel up in the Arctic, above the Arctic Circle. And I know that there's a mine in Canada, but the Russians have a nickel mining operation up above the Arctic Circle also. And
I see.
One of the things that I'm pretty sure that the Russians actually have their only it's a kind of an ice breaking commercial ship, not so much an icebreaker as it is an ore carrier that has an ice breaking bow, and it's designed to carry ore, particularly nickel. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but it's also nuclear powered. All right, so I appreciate you coming on tonight. Pretty interesting conversation, and I've always been interested in the fast reactors, although I am particularly interested in fast reactors that may be able to use gaseous cooling, because I still am very interested in a different kind of heat engine rather than the steam plant, because I guess the reason for that is I spent about half a dozen years operating steam plants, learned to love them, and also recognize why in the fossil fuel industry, unless you have to, you don't use a steam plant anymore.
Right. Yeah, that certainly is a nice feature. One of the problems I see with the gas-cooled reactors is that they use a pellet fuel, am I correct?
Yes.
And that fuel is, as I understand it, extremely hard to reprocess. It's not economical to reprocess it, which means that there's going to be a lot more waste, long-term waste, that... Can't be easily consumed.
Well,
and it can't be converted to fast reactor fuel for full consumption. So it does not really solve the long-term waste problem.
Well, in actuality, it's possible to have a gas-cooled fast reactor using that particle fuel. And the way you do that is you vary the concentration or the ratio of metal to carbon. The pebble bed reactors that are being designed, say, for South Africa, have an awful lot of carbon in the or graphite in the fuel design fuel matrix. But
right.
In some programs, particularly one that General Atomics has been running with the Kurchatov Institute in Russia, they get a lot of the graphite out of the system, still using TRISO particles, and come up with a gas-cooled fast reactor where the neutron spectrum is much, much harder than it is in a thermal reactor, and are able to achieve very similar ratios, consumption ratios, as to what you can do in a fast reactor. Now, the problem is that they get a very high burn-up on the first pass, and then that nobody's yet figured out how to get a second pass like you do with the...
That's the problem. And also, I believe that it has to be pretty high enrichment, doesn't it?
Well, high enrichment, true, but as you mentioned, in some parts of the world, not economy, I guess, but the world stockpile, there's an awful lot of enriched material available, either U-235 coming out of bomb programs or plutonium-239 coming out of bomb programs. So,
yes, well, that sounds like a lot today, but in terms of the global need, it's pretty small.
That's true. It will eventually run out, but my personal, and again, I may be thinking of things a little bit simplistically, but it seems to me that the material that we have, the highly enriched and the plutonium-239 materials, may be enough to get us building quite a few seeds for a seed and blanket type design, which could extend the burn up for quite some time, because the seeds make the blankets turn into seeds.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. Long term, the growth of nuclear power could be limited by the amount of fissile material that's available, and so it really would behoove us not to waste plutonium-239. Too soon, because eventually we might live to regret it. You or I won't, but our descendants might.
Right. Well, I'm not suggesting that we would burn up the plutonium-239 without using it to create some more. Like I said, it's kind of a seed corn thing for me. Is if you can put them in the plutonium-239 in the center, and then surround it by a blanket of fertile material.
Yeah.
After you've run the blanket out, run the seed out, then the blanket's got your fissile material, and you can kind of keep that going at least for a while until we get better. I'm sure that.
Yeah, well, that's the breeder concept, isn't it?
Right. I'm sure there's an awful lot of knowledge still left to be gained. We've kind of just started scratching the surface as far as, you know, long-term operation of nuclear reactors goes. Since.
Yeah.
Heck, you were probably alive when the first nuclear reactor was operated.
I was alive?
I would imagine.
Well, yes.
I'm just guessing.
I was born in 1928. So.
Okay, so I'm guessing correctly that you were alive. I mean, my mother was 10 years old when the first nuclear reactor was ever operated. So,
uh-huh.
And she's still, you know, going along quite well. So,
yeah.
My point is that the technology of fission is a very new thing for human development. I mean, we've known about combustion for a very long time, and we're still learning more about it, you know, not terribly rapidly, but every few years there's some real interesting improvement in the ability to more efficiently burn combustible materials.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
All right. Well, George, thank you for coming on. Appreciate your time, and I hope you keep listening to the show and keep sending information, because there's always more to learn.
It's been a pleasure, Rod, and thank you very much, and keep up the good work.
Thank you.
It's easier to say, but much more difficult to do. 'Cause I could hope and pray, but never find another you.
From the producers of the Tartan Podcast and the Old Firm Podcast comes a new podcast for your Monday mornings. The Podcast Network is proud to present The Mellow Monday Show. Music with the vibe and the atmosphere and the mood that you need on a Monday morning. The Mellow Monday Show, only on the Podcast Network. Visit mellowmonday.thepodcastnetwork.com.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.